Raidieraksts drošinātājs.
At the beginning, I need to ask what exactly this International Center for Ukraine Victory does and for what purpose it was created.
So we established the International Center for Ukrainian Victory in the first days of the full-scale war with a very ambitious goal. First, to deliver to the world the message that Ukraine is capable of winning this war, because that was at the time when we were hearing from everywhere that Ukraine will fall in 3 days, then, well, survive at least 1 week, then maybe 2 weeks, then in a month we'll see. And that significantly slowed down any aid from the Western partners when Ukraine needed it most, because Western partners were seeking how Ukraine will go through this time. Our main goal was to mobilize world for supporting Ukrainian victory and provide all of the necessary resources as soon as possible. And of course, the main priority was, especially in 2022, but still today, is the military aid and everything that we need on the battlefield, because the future of this war and the future of Ukraine will be decided on the battlefield. Whatever some people, you know, want to believe in, that it can end with a deal, I mean, it's about Ukraine restoring full control over entire sovereign territory. Then it's also about sanctioning Russia, because we are seeing 13 packages of the EU sanctions, we are seeing, you know, G7 sanctions, but unfortunately none of them managed to bring the eventual goal, bankrupt Russian war machine. And if we speak, for example, about energy sanctions in 2022-2023, Russia managed to earn on selling oil and gas and subproducts to the world $650 billion. That's a lot. I mean, with earnings like that, Russia can be committing this genocide almost indefinitely. Russians continue getting all of the necessary components and high technologies, microchips, whatever high-tech equipment they need for their arms industry, for their missiles, for their drones. I mean, Kinjal missile, their hypersonic ballistic missile, it has 78 Western-made components. Most of them were manufactured in the US, but not only. I mean, this is scandalous. Again, with the resources like that, Russia can be committing this war for a very, very long time. Then we also work on the confiscation of Russian assets, because from our perspective, it's killing two birds with one stone, depriving Russia of the resources and providing them to Ukraine. And accountability, because it is Russia which is destroying, and it is Russia which has to pay for the bill for this war. And the bill is already almost $500 billion. And then we also work on Ukraine's energy and nuclear safety. We explain why the attacks on our energy infrastructure are very dangerous, not only for Ukraine, but for entire Europe. We remind about Russia violating integrity of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which they actually turned the largest nuclear power plant in Europe literally into the military base. And we are on the brink of the nuclear catastrophe. It is just, you know, kind of the God is protecting all of us. And that was even the statement of AE director Grossi, that it's pure luck that nothing has happened there. And, you know, not a single sanction against Rosatom, which is committing this nuclear terrorism, was applied. And of course, Ukraine's EU and NATO membership as the sustainable long-term guarantees that Ukraine is anchored to the West and basically is not in the gray zone anymore.
What are those people and organizations that are working in this center? What are those people, you and who are the others?
This is actually the kind of a coalition umbrella for the international advocacy and this mobilization for victory. But this initiative was established by the female civil society leaders, experts from three main Ukrainian organizations. anti-corruption action center, that's organization which I am representing, OPORA, that's the top organization that is doing electoral monitoring in Ukraine, and ANTS network, Hanna Hopko is from that organization, and they are doing a lot on decentralization and Ukraine's EU integration. So basically all of us before 2022 had an extensive experience on cooperating with international partners, but we were mostly working together on Ukrainian reforms. Anti-corruption, rule of law, decentralization, all things democracy building. But when the full-scale war started, well, of course, reforms are very important, but to have the place to implement them, you have to preserve the sovereignty. So first things first, and we turned our advocacy activities like literally upside down and started mobilizing international partners for supporting the victory. But of course we continue working on reforms even now, since one of the main goals of this war is not to allow Ruskiy Mir, with all of the, you know, the negative features it has, to root in Ukraine. And of course, everything started with the Revolution of Dignity in 2013-2014, where Ukrainians very clearly set like European integration and these European values, rule of law, anti-corruption as top priorities. And people continue calling this in the public opinion polls to be issues they are expecting Ukrainian government to continue resolving. So reforms are super important. We work on them because that's the way for us to join European Union and NATO. So we continue basically on both tracks now.
Mm-hmm. So this is the International Center for Ukrainian Victory. So can you maybe describe more how exactly can you achieve this victory? It has often been said that Ukraine's victory can be basically achieved only on the battlefield, militarily defeating Russia. So, but what are your weapons to achieve this?
Well, yes, we think that absolutely inevitable part of Ukrainian victory is a military victory, because without full restoration of the control of Ukrainian government over entire Ukrainian territory, it won't be victory. And the military experts, generals, like for example Ben Hodges, they explain very well in details, you know, on what should be the strategy. And we are very often hearing from Western partners that, oh, but Crimea is the red line. But Crimea is absolutely the same territory of Ukraine according to the international law as Lviv or Kyiv or Donetsk. And, you know, limiting Ukrainian ability to be liberating some territories and some not, that's, you know, basically accepting Russian imperialism. And this is definitely not the thing. So full restoration of control is very important. And, in terms of, you know, weapons, well, I think that it has been already told already many times that we need weapons in sufficient quantities and in time according to the requests of Ukrainian government. Why I stress on each and every pillar of this, you know, weapons thing, is that the dynamics of the war is changing dramatically. Let's take an example, modern battle tanks. If Leopard 2 tanks or Abrams tanks arrived in Ukraine by autumn 2022, counteroffensive in Kherson and Kharkiv regions, they could have created the real wow effect on the battlefield. But they arrived in spring 2023, and Russia was gifted time to build very sophisticated the Surovikin defense lines. And you know the potential of the modern battle tanks to have a significant impact on the battlefield was significantly reduced because of that. And right now, Ukraine is asking for the long-range missiles, you know, in order to be able to hit legitimate military targets in the occupied territories, but also inside Russia. I mean, the fact, you know, that some countries are banning their use of their weapons on for Ukraine on hitting legitimate military targets. And here, I mean, I'm stressing that because it's about Russian capacity of waging this war. And you cannot be, I mean, any military expert knows that you cannot be having, you know, the war in a super small limited territory when the supply chains are much longer and when, you know, the fuel, for example, comes. Or even let's take, you know, air defense. Striking the launchers, that's one thing. Trying to shoot down missiles, ballistic cruise or drones that are already above your energy facilities or above your peaceful towns, that's a whole different story. And the efficiency of the first mean and the second one is absolutely different. And so that's why we have to be fighting against the root of the problem. And for 2 years, you know, the partners wanted us to fight against consequences, which is obviously much less effective and much more complicated. So military victory, but then also accountability. We have to understand that Russia is almost permanently waging wars. And, you know, they were never brought to account for invading Ukraine in 2014. They were never brought to account to horrible war crimes they have committed in Syria, Georgia, Moldova, and plenty of other wars, you know, before. And this vicious circle of impunity encourages them to move forward and to do each and every aggression much more violent than the previous one. So accountability for us, that's the tribunal for Russian aggression. Of course, with Putin not being protected by any state immunity. Then it's also reparations, of course, and full compensation of damages, which are already almost $500 billion. But we also have to understand that this is calculated damages. You cannot calculate the damages in the occupied territories. Plus, it was before Russia started intensified attacks against our energy system in March, May 24. And in Kharkiv alone, the damages to the electricity generation and heating generation already amount to $10 billion. And we also know that Russians are waging scorched earth tactics. So when they are retreating, they are simply destroying everything. Or when they are trying to capture something, they are also destroying it. That's what we are presently seeing in the Kharkiv region, for example, with Vovchansk. So the damages will keep growing. And the sooner Ukraine has the resources to stop damages from coming, you know, the better, because we see a lot of partners, you know, there will be in Berlin this big Ukraine recovery conference, but when partners are focusing on reconstruction instead of prioritizing military aid, you know, it's also a vicious circle, because those damages will continue coming, and you, what's the point in reconstructing if you cannot protect, and the Russian missile will arrive in a month, will destroy, you know, what was rebuilt. Then it's also Ukraine's integration into EU and NATO, as I've said, into EU, that's important guarantee for our reforms and for our economic potential development. NATO, that's the security umbrella without which it would be very complicated for Ukraine to return refugees home, because they would need long-term guarantees that this war won't restart over again in the next 5-7 years. And also a guarantee to attract investments, because when everybody is speaking, you know, about private capital rushing to Ukraine after the war ends, well, I have also serious questions what private companies will come if they do not have the guarantees of the sustainable peace, and that their facilities or factories won't be destroyed or occupied when Russia comes, renews their capacities and comes for the next phase of the imperialistic conquest. Mm-hmm.
convincing the international community about all those things and for more support for Ukraine or for supporting Ukraine at all is I guess it's a big challenge, and especially it is a challenge to convince these so-called Global South countries. Do you see the more focus should be towards the West, or more focus towards this Global South countries, or it's like even?
Well, it is the West which can and should help us win. So, of course, the main priority of our work should be the West. The countries of the global regions, global south, they are, of course, very important, but that's the task for decades, you know, and it won't have immediate implications on the on our survival efforts right now. So, those things should definitely go in parallel. But in terms of prioritization, it's of course working with Western countries. I think what is very important is to understand that this is not the war of Russia against Ukraine. This is the war of autocracies trying to substitute the world order, rules-based world order, with the principle might is right. You know, who is stronger, then they set the rules. And Ukraine is just the first theater of this war. Because in 2014, it was purely Russia against Ukraine. Right now, Russia relies very heavily on the weapons deliveries from Iran and North Korea. We know that, there are a lot of media reports that China is supporting Russia economically and with some technologies, and also helping them, possibly with the weapons deliveries too. The alliance of tyrannies is getting stronger. And of course, we have to understand that those countries definitely need something back. And Russia has a lot of technologies. Russia has nuclear technologies. And that's probably what might be interesting to Iran, which wants to finalize their development of the nuclear weapons. And we've read also the report that North Korea is getting some technologies on the more sophisticated fighter jets that Russia has. So they are having absolutely mutually beneficial cooperation. And if this, the war machine of this alliance of tyrannies is let to continue growing, at a certain point, it would be impossible to stop it, because it would need to be fighting, waging war, in order to refuel itself, because that's how the war economies are working. And in that regard, the Global South countries are watching this kind of confrontation, and they will be picking the side. And of course, in the world where rules do not work anymore, they might be leaning towards those who are mighty, or at least those who are ready to display their might. Because from my perspective, the West, of course, is much richer, much stronger than the alliance of tyrannies, but also much more scared. And I think that, the way how, let's say, North Korea alone can supply Russia with 1.5 million of artillery shells, an entire European Union cannot deliver their pledge, is a message which those countries are taking notes of when they will be, seeking for their place in the future. So I think that we, the West, Ukraine, we have to be much more creative in terms of engaging those countries. But first of all, they will be assessing the general behavior. They will be reading the signs, of the support as long as it takes, cannot continue anymore. Ukraine gave up third largest nuclear arsenal, and we are not even receiving sufficient aid, to be able to defend ourselves, while Russia is having their partnership being very, very strong. And I think what is also very important is to not to let those third countries help Russia circumvent and avoid sanctions. And I think that the approach of secondary sanctions is absolutely viable, and it should be applied. Because if we speak about technologies, I mean, of course, nobody in the West sells technologies directly to Moscow, or at least I hope they are not selling directly to Moscow. But Russia has plenty of shell companies in Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkey, other countries. And, you know, as a company, when you are seeing that before February 2024, you didn't have any customers from Kyrgyzstan, and then all of a sudden there comes the new company set up, which buys, you know, half of your production, it is a red flag. And if the due diligence is done correctly, then things like that, you know, should be shut down immediately. But that needs political will, and we are returning back to the fundamental question of what is the end game of our partners in this war. Is this supporting Ukrainian victory, or is this helping Ukraine not to fall to Russia? Because if that's Ukrainian victory, then the goal defines the means, and the means should be in a much larger quantities. If that is supporting Ukraine not failing, then in the protracted war, it would be super expensive for the West, super. And I doubt that the West has such resources. And that's a trap in which the West puts itself. And if Ukraine loses the war, that will be the end of the Western credibility in the eyes of all of the third countries, absolutely. Because the West cannot fulfill their commitment.
Let's turn to corruption. You are also the member of the board of the Ukrainian non-governmental organization Anti-Corruption Action Center, so I wanted to talk about this more in detail. It's no secret that this problem exists in Ukraine, but at first I would like to ask for you to describe how serious was this corruption even before the war, before the Maidan, on which scale it was?
Actually, corruption and the lack of the rule of law and the lack of effective system of justice was one of the main reasons which brought us to the streets of the Revolution of Dignity. Because it started as Euromaidan, it started as a protest, primarily youth, a youngsters' protest against Yanukovych not signing association agreement. And, you know, they were dancing, they were kind of spending days and nights for 1 week in the Maidan, and it was a pretty cheerful protest. And then overnight, we had very severe beatings by the Berkut riot police of the protesters who wanted to disperse these youngsters who wanted, you know, who stood up for Ukraine's European future with force, you know, and with gas. They beaten them, and that actually drove tens of thousands of Ukrainians to the street, because that was not about European Union or about, you know, association agreement anymore. It was about justice. And it was about, you know, Ukrainian state being against Ukrainian citizens. And but of course, you know, European values and European flags and all those things, zero tolerance to corruption, rule of law, they played very important role for our morale and for helping us to see the light in the end of the tunnel. But the overall idea was fight for justice as a fundamental, you know, demand of the Ukrainian society. And during Yanukovych presidency, Ukraine was utterly corrupt. I mean, it's impossible to assess clearly because there was a very big secrecy, you know. We didn't have that much data published, I mean, state data. Investigative journalists were doing the reports, but they were, like, very complicated to do, and they were very, partial because of the lack of the information. But they were doing amazing job, of course, and it was very risky for their lives to do that. You know, so when the Revolution of Dignity won, and the new government came, they were pretty serious with doing the reforms because there was very high demand from the Ukrainian society, but there was also a very big demand from the international partners, because most of the aid, macrofinancial assistance from the European Union or IMF loans were all conditioned to the clear specific reforms deliverables. The European Union gave us EU visa liberalization action plan, which was also conditioned to the reforms. And all those things, they were very powerful leverages of doing the reforms. And in between 2014, 2022, we managed to achieve substantial progress in the following areas: transparency. I mean, public procurement was put online into the auction system Prozorro, and previously it was done behind the closed doors and nobody actually had any knowledge about those procurements. And of course, ordinary entrepreneurs couldn't run because they didn't have access to the public procurements. And that's, of course, a lot of money too. Now it's public, everybody can apply. And what is even more important, it's in the form of auction, meaning that people are bargaining and, you know, the price is going down because of that. That's important. We have opened a number of registries, like the registry of land, real estate, vehicles, beneficial ownership of the companies, and a lot of other, which brought big transparency and established a lot of the tools for the investigative journalists and the civil society. We established the electronic asset declaration system, where all of the public officials have to report on their assets and incomes, which is very important for monitoring the lifestyles of officials, but also important to monitor, you know, the integrity of the candidates for the different important jobs, like, for example, the judicial jobs or top ministerial positions and whatever other important offices are. And then we managed to build from scratch, rather successfully, the system of criminal justice for high-profile corruption. That's National Anti-Corruption Bureau, Specialized Anti-Corruption Prosecutor's Office, and High Anti-Corruption Court. These are totally separate bodies from the police, prosecutor's office, and they have exclusive jurisdiction over high-profile corruption cases. And they truly started going after big fish. You know, they put behind bars the head of the Supreme Court, which is obviously top office in the government. They put the charges against oligarch Kolomoisky. They were looking a lot into the schemes related to many other oligarchs. Well, of course, they are smart. They are not registering corruption schemes on their own names. But a lot of the people, you know, top level officials that were heads of different schemes, they were also put behind bars. And also, what is from my perspective a very important result of their work is that they managed to put several dozen judges behind bars, because previously, you know, judges were untouchables and not a single judge would put other judge behind bar, because they know that, you know, tomorrow their peers may do something against them as well. So that is broken too. But what we didn't manage to finish before the start of the full-scale war is the comprehensive judicial reform. And so we did manage to kind of build the separate islands of integrity for the high-profile corruption cases, but cleaning entire judiciary, cleaning entire prosecutor's office would take a lot of time, of course, and that would, the judges, the system pushes back a lot against them, any changes or any reforming. Those reforms, and particularly the reform of the judiciary, they received the second breath with the EU candidate status, because they were part of the seven steps, seven conditionalities. And we've tried several times to do judicial reform between 2014 and 2022, but they failed, probably because we did wrong sequence of actions. And this time we started with cleansing judicial governance bodies, like top institution, which makes the decision on hiring, firing judges, administrative and disciplinary cases against them, transferring from one court to another one, like the judges for judges. We completed last summer this part of the reform. And now those judicial governance bodies would need to clean the courts, basically the first instance and the court of appeal. And I'm cautiously optimistic because this composition of the judicial governance bodies, and we have two of them, comparing to the previous one, indeed much better. And we have more agents of change presently there. But cleansing courts would take additional time. It is ongoing right now. I mean, we have around 2,000 vacancies of judges in Ukraine, because when we were doing the reform of the judicial governance bodies, there were no judicial governance, and there was basically a vacuum in the decision making in the judiciary. So we didn't have the bodies to appoint. So, you know, the number of vacancies was growing. And right now they would need to first fill those vacancies to make courts more operational, and then they will look into existing judges whether they are professional enough and meet the integrity standards.
If I'm not mistaken, there was this not so to say scandal, but at some point there was news that Zelensky administration doing some kind of changes regarding the anti-corruption bodies to include some of the one of the bodies into another, which would be directly under the direct influence also from the Zelensky's office. So what are the risks there? Are there any risks from the current president's office to somehow badly influence those anti-corruption bodies or no?
Well, unfortunately, president's office is not a reformer in terms of fight against corruption, because there is still an official, Oleg Tatarov, who is working there, who is in charge of the law enforcement and justice sector reforms. And he himself is not a reformer. He was the subject to NABU investigation, which was closed a few years ago because it was taken away from NABU and transferred to the SBU, Security Service of Ukraine, which closed this case, obviously on the political motives. So why president keeps Oleg Tatarov, we have no idea. We continue, demanding his dismissal, because it shows President Zelensky it undermines President Zelensky's commitment to do the reforms when he has people like this in his office who are actually in charge of this very main direction. So in that regard, there is the risk, but fortunately we have very strong attention of the international partners to the work of anti-corruption institutions and their independence. And Ukraine depends a lot on the external funding and external finances. And I know that that's the stance of the European Union, IMF, that those anti-corruption bodies should be independent and should do their work properly, and that nobody should interfere into that. So from that regard, I'm kind of more optimistic that they would be let to do their job properly, because there is this international safeguard.
There's this Transparency International in rating. Some say that in the last years, Ukraine has achieved incredible progress. On the other hand, there are those ones who said that there is still a lot of corruption in the country. How would you assess those achievements now?
Well, you have to understand that corruption perception is about perception. And as I've said already, we managed to build a very strong transparency in the country, but accountability, of course, was lagging behind because, you know, opening up registries, that's one thing, and building, you know, the investigation, then prosecution, then courts, then giving time the courts to deliver justice, and then there's first instance, second instance, of course, that's much more time. So at a certain point, there was, you know, this perception that in Ukraine, everything is corrupt because you are having the reports everywhere. Investigative journalists are doing their job great. Civil society is reporting. There are arrests. There are searches. NABU is doing amazing job, like searches, you know, every single week. Nobody is put behind bars. It's like, how come, you know? And but fortunately, right now we are seeing that, as I've said, you know, the big fish. Because people want big fish. People are not satisfied with, let's say, you know, heads of the state-owned enterprises who were the main chiefs of very lucrative schemes for decades, you know, making money on, let's say, Ukrainian resources, which, are the ownership of Ukrainian people, but somehow the fortunes on those resources were made by several oligarchs. So it's not kind of outcome they wish. They want all of the oligarchs behind bars and, you know, half of the politicians. Well, of course, I'm joking, but I mean, you know, people want substantial figures behind bars. And even in the well-matured democracies and rule of law countries, we are seeing that, you know, high-profile trials, they last for years. Sometimes they might take, you know, decade. If you really want that to be rule of law and not a politically motivated case. But indeed, the perception index is improving. It is improving since 2014, but it made a hike, plus 3 points in 2023, during the second year of the full-scale war, which from my perspective was pushed by the EU candidate status and those reforms that were implemented within it, but which also shows that Ukrainian society is committed to doing the reforms and that we can be doing such complicated things even when defending from the full-scale genocide. So I'm pretty optimistic. I understand that we still have big homework to do, that's true, and we cannot say that, you know, all of the problems are solved, but I think that it's very fair when assessing Ukraine's progress is to first see the starting point during Yanukovych presidency, then see the big way that Ukraine managed to travel since 2014, and then appreciate that it was done during the wartime that started in 2014, including full-scale genocide since 2022.
That was also my question. How can you be efficient doing the reforms when it's a full-scale war in the country? It must be much slower and much harder than, like, well, before 2022.
Or on the contrary, you know, the full-scale war is also an opportunity because, you know, you have to become much more effective. And, you know, I think that with this regard, Ukrainian armed forces are probably the best example on how to do miracles with the super limited resources that you have. And of course, if you want to survive, you have to mobilize, you have to do better. And that is that brings the difficulties, but that also creates the window of opportunities which we have to utilize.
Can you name those areas where corruption is observed most often these days? Is it still, I don't know, police, those judicial bodies?
Well, I would say that there is, you know, corruption where most money going. So that's why we are looking very closely into Ministry of Defense procurements, because there was last winter the scandal with the procurement of food and then procurement of clothes, which ended with the resignation of the previous Ministry of Defense, Ryaznikov. And after that, a number of very important institutional changes were implemented to limit the possibility for corruption. Like there were new agencies established for the procurement, new people were hired them, and right now the efficiency of work of these agencies are much better, which means that, you know, it is not, the issue is not the existence of corruption, because corruption exists literally everywhere, you know, and including in Europe, European countries, but it has just different forms. You know, it's more about money laundering, it's more about, you know, the dirty money from the autocrats, and less about, I don't know, bribes to the police officers, which, by the way, is not a case anymore in Ukraine, because we did manage to reform this patrol police and others. But it's about how are you handling it. And when there is, you know, corruption exposed, is this properly addressed or is this left unaddressed? And I think that Ukraine does manage to address corruption issues, particularly because, you know, the society is so traumatized by injustice of war that when it sees injustice of corruption, it might cause, you know, even more dissatisfaction and more frustration in the society. And another area, important area, where we are thinking ahead and where we want to establish safeguards to make sure that corruption doesn't exist there or is, you know, reduced to the very minimum, is reconstruction. And one of the ideas which my colleagues are presently developing and which was submitted to the parliament is to oblige all of the construction projects to publish online the cost estimates. How does corruption look like in public procurement? You know, there is some margin which is added to the price of some, you know, either service or bricks or, you know, concrete or whatever else. And then, you know, this money is being laundered. So, and investigative journalists will be able to take this cost breakdown, compare the cost to the market cost, and see whether, you know, it is more or less market level or, you know, there is some significant difference. And I'm sure that when this is implemented, it will be a very powerful and preventive tool, because when officials would know that everything would go very transparent, even with the projects like that, you know, the temptation for the corruption would be significantly reduced. So yes, courts continue to be the issue, but as I've told already, I'm pretty optimistic that we would be able to clean that too. So basically, as of now, there are two main goals. First one is to clean those systems that were not reformed before. And the second, to put all of the possible safeguards to make sure that corruption is not appearing in the new areas where most of the money will be going because of the war and because of the post-war recovery and reconstruction.
How does cases of corruption during wartime affect the public trust to the officials right now, especially if it's in the military field and structures?
Every big corruption case which we had over the last 2 years, they were more or less properly addressed. So there were dismissals, almost immediate dismissals of the officials suspected. And then there are criminal cases that are investigated by NABU, and there are trials currently happening. There are no verdicts yet, but the fact that there is justice being served is, of course, sending encouraging signals. But I mean, as a Ukrainian, of course, I'm very frustrated that corruption still sometimes exists. At the same time, you have to understand that when the full-scale war started, all of the transparency measures were rolled back, of course, because from the security reasons. And lack of transparency is a very encouraging environment for corruption. And unfortunately, you know that some officials abused this lack of transparency for their own needs. Well, I mean, it it was logical. I mean, it's very important to make sure that this is, that these are still exceptions and not the tendency. And these are exceptions and not the tendency. So I think that the, I would say that the response is more or less satisfying. But still, the society continues watching, and the society continues demanding, you know, the finalization of those anti-corruption reforms that are not yet finished.
Doing reforms, it's more up to Ukraine itself, of course, but how do Ukrainian partners are involved in this process? Are it's only advising, or it's...
They are helping, of course, they are advising, but I think that the most powerful help is conditionalities of the Western aid and IMF program, which is very important for Ukrainian macrofinancial stability, is fully conditioned on different reforms, not only anti-corruption, but anti-corruption is a big part there. But I think that the most powerful leverage of doing reforms will be Ukraine's accession, because these fundamental chapters, that's chapter 23, 24, it's about rule of law and justice, and those chapters will be the first one to open and the last one to close, which means that European Union would pay very strong attention to the reforms to be real and not faked. Because after the experience of accepting Bulgaria and Romania, countries that still have some issues with corruption, European Union significantly strengthened in their accession process this part on the rule of law. So I'm optimistic that, you know, with the support in the society equal to more than 80%, you know, it will be political suicidal for anyone in the government to oppose the reforms which European Union would demand for Ukraine's European integration.
How Ukrainians perceive the corruption right now? I guess they see it as something bad, right? But are there enough, are there pretty, I don't know, big or some part of the society that still thinks that is like normal? It has been there like for many years and it's not up to me to change it, so let's be it if it is there.
No, I mean, it's we are closing to the zero tolerance to corruption. People demand justice. And because of the war, you know, the wounds of people are more open and people react to any injustice, be it, you know, by Russians or, you know, by some of the corrupt officials, very, very harshly. So, and, you know, corruption, autocracy, violations of the human rights, all those things, they are part of Ruskiy Mir, which we are fighting against. And for Ukrainians, it's very important to make sure that, you know, from this war, we reemerge like a phoenix, not only victorious over Russia, but also victorious over our domestic issues that were, that Russia has been abusing for very long, because Ukraine's corruption has been the strategic tool of Russian influence over Ukraine, you know, and not only over Ukraine. I mean, strategic corruption Russia is using over European countries, over a lot of the other states too. So that's the vulnerability that needs to be closed.
What would you say, how safe it is right now for, I don't know, ordinary Ukrainian to tell someone that he knows that they're somewhere, I don't know, at some structure, I saw there was a corruption, this man offered a bribe to that. Whether he knows, where should he go and inform the law, I don't know, law enforcement or someone, and if he thinks that it is safe to inform about this?
Well, I think that it regards the policy on protection of whistleblowers, and we have a separate agency which is in charge of that. I wouldn't say that we have achieved some significant results here or achievements to be very proud of. So I would say that it is more on the initial phase, but the attitude is changing, of course, towards the positive.
Have you maybe encountered, I don't know, some kind of a corruption, some kind of offers, or your colleagues during your work as well?
Well, I never worked at as the public official. I was working in the Kyiv City Council in 2014, 2015, but nobody, of course, offered anything like that to me because I always had an anti-corruption background, and you would be pretty dumb to go to the people, to somebody with anti-corruption background and offer them something. But that's a very interesting thing because there are public opinion polls where people, I don't remember the exact numbers, but people continue naming fight against corruption as top priority, that we have to continue fighting that. And then there's the question, have you encountered corruption in your life or in recent years? And most people say no, because, you know, biggest, like a possibility, you know, of corruption is when there is a human being as an intermediary, you know, before the citizen and the state. And with regards to that, you know, Ukraine managed to do a lot in terms of digitalization. And I remember that to get my first foreign passport, that was, I guess, 20 years ago or something like that, I had to stand in a very, very long line for almost entire day in the corridor without air conditioning, you know, to submit the documents, and then the same thing to get my passport back. So the system was built the way that you will say, come on, I don't want to suffer, I give the bribe, and you know, my passports are my documents are submitted without the line. Right now we are having the administrative centers, like a very beautiful places where you have the electronic queue, you're coming, you know, you spend their maximum 1 hour, you submit everything, then you're receiving an SMS that your document is ready. 20 years ago my document was prepared half a year, 6 months. Right now, you know, that the document is prepared in the normal procedure 3 weeks, in the expedited procedure 5 working days. And I mean, of course, there is no space for corruption because everything is built, you know, for my comfort. And, you know, we have this GIA app, where we have all of the documents, where you can actually apply, you know, to make some changes. If you are an individual entrepreneur, you know, I'm buying their war bonds because I want to support Ukrainian economy, and I'm kind of going there on DIA, and it takes me like 10 minutes, and you know, I'm kind of simultaneously investing my money and supporting my state, and you know, doing the right thing to do. So it's much more comfortable. And when you are having this digitalization, when you are having a patrol police as the ones who are not accepting bribes, then we had a very good previous minister of healthcare who started reforming Ukrainian healthcare system. And now, you know, you're having the principle money follows the patient, which means that I am a patient, I have a certain amount of money from the state for like annually, and I can go to whatever doctor I want. I sign the declaration with them, and then, you know, I'm receiving this treatment. It's not that much, of course, it's more or less basic treatment and prevention. And yes, I can go, you know, to either the doctor in the state hospital or in the private hospital. I mean, in the private hospital, of course, you are having this margin, and if you exceed it, you have to pay for the additional services. But that makes doctors compete for the patients, because, you know, if I know that this doctor is very good and I'm bringing my money and go there, that's one thing. If you know the doctor is automatically receiving money from the state for the quantity of the patients, like nameless patients, you know, we call this person per bed in the hospital, then of course they would be, you know, incentivized to forge the documents and, you know, pretend as if all of the beds in their hospitals are occupied and they are having unlimited number of patients. So see, that's the change of the principle of who defines how the money is used. When you are having, you know, this patients per bed per day approach, you are having the state and the doctors, and there is some opportunity for the schemes. If you are having money follows the patient, it makes me as the patient the final decision maker of where I want this money to be spent. And this brings much more efficiency into the system. And that, by the way, from my perspective, significantly helped us to go through COVID, because without that, we would have very long lines, you know, of people in the hospital simply do not know who are their doctors, whom to address, and how to get the treatment. And because, you know, we moved into this declaration system, I clearly knew that that's my doctor. I texted, you know, him, so I have such symptoms. What should I do? Like, oh, with these symptoms, you have to kind of, you know, go and have some additional checks, or these symptoms are fine. Be at home, you know, like drink water, do whatever, some additional, you know, treatment. And that significantly decreased the pressure on Ukrainian healthcare system.
This shadow economy, or people not paying taxes, or enterprises not paying taxes, how big this problem is in Ukraine? Is it even possible to kind of understand how much, I don't know, people or enterprises are working in this gray area?
Well, that's a good question, because my feeling is that it's significantly reduced. There are still some approaches of the optimization of taxes, I would put it this way, like through the sometimes, you know, businesses registering as a number of individual entrepreneurs, because that's then the taxes are lower. But personally, I haven't, you know, encountered any cases over the last 10 years, like you say, that, you know, I was offered a kind of two different schemes and options, officially or unofficially. So I have the feeling that this is reducing. But of course, it could be effectively tackled only when we are having the truly effective tax administration, which, by the way, wasn't effectively reformed yet. And we are presently in the process of reforming of Bureau of Economic Investigations, because earlier we had tax police, tax militia, and they were very punitive. And very often they were abused to basically put the pressure on businesses and not make them stick to the rules and to the legislation. So right now the idea is to have this Bureau of Economic Investigation, which will be like simultaneously, you know, the preventive body, analytical body, but also, you know, doing investigations like anti-corruption agencies for high-profile corruption cases, Bureau of Investigations for the economic cases. And I'm, again, cautiously optimistic that if we manage to fix this institution, and here, first of all, I mean the selection of the leadership, because if you have additional safeguards on the selection of the leadership of the body, then you increase the chances of good people to be elected there. And if we manage to get this Bureau of Economic Investigations properly working, then they will do much better on fighting against economic crimes.
And the last question I would like to ask, why to you personally it is important to work in this field, in this anti-corruption field, and try to solve these problems? What did you say?
Well, because I was also on Maidan, and I've also seen that if you do not have justice, you're having people being left alone against a big monster state, and people are defenseless. And I know that my people deserve to have rule of law, and they deserve to have real justice, especially as while we are defending from the Russian aggression. So for me, that's You know, we are joking very often that why Ukraine is so attractive for life, because never ever in the world right now you can find another country where you can accomplish so much in terms of like your professional work being part of the truly historic changes, because you are having all these agencies being established, all those reforms being done. I mean, that's the most interesting things happening. Well, of course, wartime changed that significantly, but it's very ambitious and it's something which we need to finally establish in order to fully break up with Russia and to get fully decolonized from any Russian influence. So I think that Ukrainian people deserve this, and I have to contribute with whatever I can do to make this happen and to make this happen fast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paldies Richardam, viņš sarunājās ar Olēnu Halušku, nevalstiskās organizācijas pretkorupcijas rīcības centrs, valdes locekli, cīnītāji pret korupciju Ukrainā. Nu ko? Vēl pārdomām. Iespējams, ka mums pat ir vērts pārņemt kaut ko no Ukrainas. Godīgi sakot, iespaidīgi, tiešām ņemot vērā, ka kāda cīņa šobrīd ir jāizcīna Ukrainai, ka tā spēj cīnīties arī šajā frontē, pretkorupcijas frontē, un gal galā tas ir tas, ko es paņemu no visu šī konflikta un no šīs intervijas, ir tas, ka Ukraina cīnās ne tikai par to, lai atvairītu iebrucējus, bet tā cīnās arī par to, lai izskaustu padomju okupācijas un Krievijas ietekmes sekas un iznāktu no šī kara jau pavisam kā cita valsts ar citām vērtībām. Un tas ir tikai abrīnojami, un mums neatliek nekas cits kā novēlēt, lai šī cīņa izdodas visās tās izpausmēs. Ja jums šī saruna šita interesanta vai būtiska, un tāda, kas būtu jādzird arī citiem, piespiediet tur tos īkšķīšus laikus, abonējiet mūs, un galvenais aizsūtiet saiti ar šo sarunu kādiem saviem draugiem, radiem kolēģiem, lai arī tie dzird un zin.
Jā, nu kamēr ukraiņiem karš savā ziņā, jāsaka, diemžēl, bet ir motivācija daudz ātrāk varbūt risināt reformas, varbūt arī mums ir jāsaņemas reformēt un izdarīt daudzas labas lietas un daudz labi mājas darbi, lai izvairītos no kara. Varbūt tai ir jābūt mūsu motivācijai, lai būtu gataviem jebkuriem scenārijiem šeit pie mums un būtu gatavi mēs dažādās jomās. Bet tas ir tas, kas mums šonadēļ ir sakāms, un ja jums kaut kas arī ir sakāms, kādi viedokļi, varbūt par šiem pašiem korupcijas jautājumiem, par to, ko šodien esat dzirdējuši, kādas jaunas idejas ieteikumi. Mūsu e-pasts joprojām nemainīgs, drošinātājs at latvijasradio.lv. Droši rakstiet mums, noteikti izlasīsim un novērtēsim jūsu viedokli. Tāpat arī atcerieties, ka jauna epizode kā vienmēr katru ceturtdienu, un jāatceras arī drošinātāja sauklis. Drošinātājs skaidri un personīgi par karu Ukrainā.
Raidieraksts drošinātājs.